So welcome back to the Birdie Bug Poll.
Episode 43. Right, we're back with another episode on time, which is lovely. And as always, I don't have any catch-up.
No, you don't have any catch-up. I don't have a lot. I have, I've been to the Lake District celebrating my 30th wedding anniversary.
You saw a barn owl.
Saw barn owl, saw hares. We went up there also.
Are you looking in the mirror at your head?
I was hoping to see red wings and field fares because they come in at this time of year in large flocks, particularly up in the north part of the country. And so did see some red wings, didn't see field fares. Weather wasn't great, but it was a nice break. That's about it.
The only thing, I mean, I've been trying to squeeze in as much macro photography as I can before all the critters sort of disappear. I have found a bit of success going out after dark and seeing all the spiders sort of crawl out the walls, which has been quite good fun.
But you I don't got a have bit any... in the garden here while we were away, didn't you?
Yeah, which was good fun, and I found some nice bugs and some harvestmen and stuff like
it's
that.
It's not a day for it today, is it?
No, it's chucking it down.
Pretty awful out there today.
But I haven't really done anything specific of note that's sort of catch-up worthy, I don't think.
No, I mean, no.
And given how much or how many notes you have on today's topic, it's probably best that we keep this section quite short.
We might need to crack on because actually it's a subject you could talk about. We say it's about most of our subjects, actually. We could talk about them all day and various parts of each episode and subject we could talk about all day.
Yeah, but I do think you've got half the internet written down.
Yeah, but it's important stuff.
It's good stuff. So, in that case, shall we go straight?
Yeah,
straight in?
This was one that you called, didn't it? So you do the intro.
All right, so we are back with another habitat-specific episode. I think it's been a while. I can't remember the last one we did, but we've done a few. We've done wetlands.
We've done peatlands,
seagrass meadows. Yeah. So we've done a few, and today we're going to be talking about the UK's temperate rainforests.
Yeah, and I think this is possibly a habitat that people are not really aware exist in this country.
No, I think typically
they're called rainforests, so you wouldn't think, you know, a rainforest would be in this country.
No, and I think when people see them, they would probably just call them a woodland, and aren't necessarily aware that actually we do have temperate rainforests in this country. So we thought we'd talk a little bit about what they are, what makes up a temperate rainforest, why they're an important habitat, obviously some of the cool species that inhabit them, and then talk about why they've declined, the threats they face, and then, as always, we'll look at the really cool projects.
Yeah, some good
going
stuff
on.
Actually. I've found it really encouraging. There's some good stuff, even government led stuff, which I nearly fell off my chair when I read. So because it's always a bonus, isn't it?
Yeah,
so a big bonus actually. But anyway, do you want to do the?
Yeah, I can kick it.
Tell
off.
Us what a temperate rainforest is.
Yeah, so obviously, as we've alluded to at the beginning, lots of people are familiar with the idea of a tropical rainforest and may not be aware that rainforests will happily grow in cooler climates like what we have in the UK, and that is known as a temperate rainforest. Globally, they're quite rare.
They're rarer than tropical rainforests.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at things like the Amazon and places like Borneo, logging obviously aside, the amount of land they cover in comparison to temperate rainforests is huge.
Yeah, Brazil's quite a big place, isn't it? And compared to the United Kingdom.
Obviously, they are found here in sort of the UK, British Isles, but you can also find them in Japan, New Zealand, Canada and Chile. I didn't realise that the temperate rainforests we get here are also known as Atlantic woodland or Celtic rainforests, which is quite cool. But they're essentially defined by the fact that they're a forest found in cool, moist climates and in an area with quite high levels of rainfall. I think typically that's characterises over 1,400 millimetres annually of rainfall.
Yeah, and also close to the coast as well.
Yeah, so part of the reason of being close to the coast is you tend to get a more consistent climate. So I mean, people will notice, not that we get snow as often around the UK anyway anymore, but the coastal areas don't get quite as much snow. Even when I was up in Bangor in North Wales, obviously the mountains got a lot of snow, but the coastal towns never did because it sort of keeps it quite constant, being alongside the coast. They are typically full of closed canopy, broadleaf trees, which are things like oak, birch, holly, ash, that provide quite a shaded and then sort of damp environment. Yeah. They're really quite moist as a as a habitat. And because of that, they get all sorts of fairly unique features, and that is a real high level of things like mosses and ferns, or plants known as epiphytic plants. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce
it. Plants that grow on plants.
Yeah, so epiphytes, as
I knew you'd go on and define them.
Yeah, so they are plants that grow on plants. So rather than growing on like the forest floor, things like ferns and stuff like that, they literally grow on top of other organisms. Yeah. So
I think that's also something that defines the difference of a temperate rainforest or a temperate wood to a normal, you know, deciduous or mixed
typical woodland.
It has to be wet and mild enough for plants to grow on other plants, and that's what actually defines a temperate rainforest.
You'll often find that the ground is almost like a green carpet of moss and fungi and stuff, and then plants on top of that carpet.
So even, you know, in the autumn when all the leaves drop, a temperate rainforest is still very verdant and green because of all those mosses and, you know, and lichens and things.
Well, I mean, I've got... So lichens are a real fundamental part of these temperate rainforests, and something they're very well known for. And I've got some information about them, a bit of a deep dive into lichens. But I don't know if you wanted to, if there are any other like introductory facts.
Well,
about
I think the
temperate rainforests.
The thing about temperate rainforests in the United Kingdom is that, you know, they age back to the 10,000 years ago to the Ice Age, and a fifth of the United Kingdom was covered in temperate rainforests, and it now covers less than 1%, you won't be surprised to hear, of the country. About 18,000 hectares of it in England, about 30,000 hectares in Scotland, some good temperate rainforests up in Scotland and Wales, actually. A lot of the country was covered in it, and now it's not, for reasons that we will go on to a bit later on.
Yeah, I think a fifth is, I mean, that's a big chunk of land that used to be temperate rainforest.
Like always, we have, you know, we have destroyed a really important habitat that hosts a massive amount of biodiversity. It's an incredible habitat, which, you can go on to now. Because you really want to talk lichens, don't you?
So obviously we'll give a little list of some of the other flora and fauna supported by temperate rainforests, because everything from, obviously, the invertebrates to bats and birds and even things like
that. Yeah, an amazing variety of trees and, you know, real mixed species of trees as well.
And so what I was actually going to say about lichens, I wasn't really going into the species too much, but I just thought I'd give a little background on what they are, because they're a little bit misunderstood. And to be honest, they, like everything, could have had their own episode. But it's often thought that they're a plant. They sort of, you know, they're green and look plant-like, but they're not a plant, and they're also not an animal. They are a symbiotic relationship between a fungi and something called a photobiont, or photobiont. I'm going to say biont, I think that sounds better. And essentially what that is it's a fungus that then has normally some sort of cyanobacteria or an algae that it lives symbiotically or together with. And what's really interesting is there's actually a bit of debate about the nature of that relationship. Like, are the fungi, you know, quote-unquote farming their photosynthetic photobionts, so either the algae or the cyanobacteria, in almost like a controlled parasitic way, or are the photobionts, the bacteria, actually getting a benefit as well? And I quite like the idea of fungi farming something.
I like that idea, because obviously we've talked about the incredible properties of fungi and how they have this symbiotic relationship with the roots of trees.
Go back and listen to our woodland episode.
Yeah, so they're an incredible thing,
yeah, I
aren't
mean,
they? Fungi.
There is
so
quite...
I like the idea of that.
Yeah,
of them
I
actually
do.
Fungi farming, I think, is... We need to look into that more and see whether that's actually a real thing.
There's quite a lot of evidence that it's actually more of a symbiotic, mutual relationship.
Yeah, where like they have with the trees. And...
So essentially fungi are getting their carbon source, in basically simple sugars and stuff, from the photobiont. So they photosynthesize, produce obviously the sugars and stuff like that, and then the fungi get the benefit of that. But then it's also thought that actually the photosynthetic organism might be getting, you know, beneficial nutrients and all sorts of, like, the optimal environment for them to thrive in on the fungus. So they're getting just some of the secretions and moisture and everything from the fungus is actually beneficial. So in that way, they would be working together in a nice mutualistic way. But then there is also arguments of this. Well, I like the idea of controlled parasitism, where actually up to half of the carbon fixed by algae is immediately converted to sugar, which isn't accessible to the algae itself. It goes straight to the fungus. So at that point, it's sort of robbing them of their sugars. And they also found that some lichens can form stable associations with their normal, like, host algae, would actually form a parasitic interaction with a non-host algae in a lab environment, which then implies that they are capable of this parasitic relationship. Right. So are fungi just farming photosynthetic organisms for sugars? Possibly. But anyway, so that's just a little bit of background there. The lichens, which you get very prominently in these rainforests, aren't animals, they aren't plants. They are a relationship between two organisms, fungi, and then normally a cyanobacteria or an algae.
Yeah. Fascinating.
But just really quickly, on sort of a bit more tailored to the habitat, one of the largest lichens that you get is known as the tree lungwort, and it's really quite a large organism. Got these really leaf-like lobes which literally stretch out from the trunk of a tree. And in medieval times, monks believed that the resemblance to lungs was significant and actually used it to treat lung issues, which I thought was quite interesting. And you also find things like globally rare species of fungus called the hazel gloves, which only grows on old hazel trees. And apparently it looks like a bundle of rubbery orange fingers. But again, a really rare species. And the last thing I'll say on these is that they're really important as an indicator species.
Yeah.
So lots of lichens, and to be fair, some of the fungi as well, for not the same reason, but a lot of the lichens really need good, clean air.
Yes, lack of pollution.
Yeah, and so when they start to decline, it's normally a sign that air pollution and the general environment is not particularly healthy. And then obviously when they start to come back and they're really thriving, then it starts to be like, okay, things are improving, whatever we're doing is benefiting the ecosystem. So they're really important for keeping an eye on the health of the habitat.
Yeah, we've talked about indicator species in lots of episodes, and I mean they are such important species, aren't they? We've talked about it with birds, we've talked about it with mammals, we've talked about it now with obviously lichens. So the indicator species are really important species.
Yeah, they really
are.
They
tell you a huge amount about what's going on with climate, with pesticides, with all sorts of things that we are damaging the environment with. So,
yes, but it's one of those.
Because and obviously, lichens are things that you wouldn't imagine would be an indicator species.
And when we go on to one of the, or sort of the importance of these temperate rainforest, one of them is as the lungs of
tonight,
which obviously we've spoken about in the woodland episode, and also in episodes about things like the krill and ocean stuff, but they are another sort of lung of the planet. They're responsible for a huge amount of cleaning of the air, and so it makes sense that you've got organisms that would like to thrive in nice healthy atmosphere, that you can sort of, it's a good visual cue as to whether the habitat is healthy. But there you go, a little bit of background information on lichens. And you can get, I think, over 200 different species of...
And some really rare ones. In fact, some lichens and mosses in temperate rainforests are found only in that environment, nowhere else on the planet. So
yeah, they're really... It is like their perfect habitat, nice, moist,
sort of damp,
year-round. Yeah. It's really perfect for them.
Yeah.
Anyway, that is lichens.
So I'll just talk a little bit about the... You know, well, trees make up an Atlantic wood, let's call it that, because in this country, obviously Britain's rainforests are mainly, the mainstay really are oak trees, but it's not quite, they don't grow in quite the same way as you would see in a sort of the straight oaks of a lowland England woodland. The temperate rainforest oaks tend to be stunted and small, and they're windblown and gnarled, because obviously they're enduring the Atlantic gales, and they're often affected by that climate on the coast. and so they're hunched low to the ground to withstand those Atlantic gales, and
just bracing their roots themselves.
And their roots are often clutching onto very thin upland soil as well. So a temperate rainforest is a slightly different structure to a traditional
woodland,
English oak woodland. But you'll get a whole variety of species of trees and a real mix depending on what part of the country you're in as well. So you'll get holly and birch and rowan and hazel, a real mix in the British temperate rainforest, and that varies depending on what part of the country you're in. So in the windswept upland areas, you get hardy hawthorn, that does really well. But on the wetter ground, closer to the streams and brooks, you'll get willow, and then the Scottish rainforests are very different. You'll get birch, and there's some really, really old, ancient hazel woods that date back thousands of years up on the west coast of Scotland. So the temperate rainforest species do vary from depending on what part of the country they're in. Obviously, all of them are very affected by a coastal environment and climate. So you get a real variety of trees plants. So
the line I had about why you get the rainforest in the areas that you've mentioned, you know, Scotland, Wales, yeah. Snowdonia in yeah. Wales, and parts of Devon, Cornwall and the Lake District, and obviously Dartmoor as well, is that they receive the highest rainfall. The surrounding yeah. landscape of, obviously in Wales and Scotland, mountains and coastal areas trap all that moisture yeah. and it creates that real damp.
So it's permanently damp yeah. and, you know, dripping wet most of the
Which
time.
I know obviously there's distinctions between tropical and temperate rainforest, but it's not really surprising that they're both characterised by a high level of water.
Moisture, yeah. It's all about...
It's in the name really,
yeah,
isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So, and obviously it supports, you know, they support a huge amount of a variety of wildlife as well. I think you had some things on.
Yeah, well, I listed them off really quickly, but as far as things like mammals go, we obviously typically see grey squirrels in the UK now, which aren't native, but are native red squirrels. Most of their little strongholds they have are in temperate rainforests. A lot yeah. they really love a temperate rainforest. A lot of our bat species, the horseshoe bats, really thrive in our rainforest as well as rare things like pine martens.
Yeah.
Absolutely love them. Obviously, with any sort of forest and woodland type habitat, the invertebrate life I could just sit and list for hours.
But yeah.
Absolutely perfect for all sorts of beetles because you get wet wood, which is their perfect environment, as well as butterflies and, well, snails and slugs. But yeah. all of the invertebrate life really absolutely thrives there because it's full of wood and other things to eat and decaying matter and stuff like that. So the invertebrate life is absolutely abundant.
Yeah, and that invertebrate life is really important for the birds that yeah, it attracts as well. You get a lot of migrant birds coming in that really thrive in those temperate rainforests because of that invertebrate, that abundance of invertebrates. So you get pied flycatchers, wood warblers, red starts as well. They love scrubbing around in that damp environment,
yeah,
the leaf litter and tree pipits as well. And they'll come in, you know, they'll come in and to breed each summer, and they'll feed up and obviously feed their young from that fantastic resource in a rainforest. And you get other things that are becoming quite rare now, believe it or not, of jays. Jays do really well in temperate rainforests as well.
And they're always very
because
much
of the oak trees and the acorns, they have a huge appetite for
yeah,
acorns.
Yeah, they're a real woodland bird anyway.
Real woodland
they?
Bird. So that you get a fantastic variety of birds which are becoming, obviously, as the habitat becomes rarer, those birds are becoming more threatened as well. Things like pied flycatchers are very threatened, and their numbers are reducing rapidly. So it's hugely important as ever to recognise that habitat yeah. and how important they are for this huge variety of wildlife that it supports.
I think, I mean, this applies to the fauna as well as the flora, but yeah. with the epiphytes, those like ferns that grow on other plants, as well as obviously the lichens I've already mentioned, but the various fungi and mosses I think the line that I saw, that's one of the most diverse habitats across Europe for those groups of organisms. And again, it's not really surprising when you look at the diversity that tropical rainforests get. And I know it's different. You've got the higher temperatures, and that obviously brings in all the reptiles and all sorts of exotic to us animals. But that habitat, a constant, you know, it's not, the forest isn't dying back or anything, constant temperature, dampness, nice humidity. It is just perfect for so many animals, and probably because it's so good for the invertebrates, it just brings in everything that eats them, and so they do end up being properly biodiverse habitats.
And yeah, and I think it's the same with all of this this habitat loss. You know, the, as I alluded to earlier on, a fifth of the country was covered in temperate rainforest, and now there's only 1% is covered in temperate rainforest. So all of that native biodiversity, all that native wildlife that relied on that habitat so much, is, you know, obviously is affected hugely. So this is another reason why, you know, the decline of wildlife in this country is happening.
Yeah. Well, in that case, unless you've got some cultural significance,
Atlantic rainforests are woven into Celtic mythology. You
Celtic
said,
forests,
you know,
they're
often called Celtic forests, and there's stories. It's called the Mabinogi. And it's one of the earliest examples of prose in British literature, and it's thought to be about 1,000 years old. And it was all, it was a whole series of books that were made up and written for children. But it was all these sort of little fantasy stories of fairies and pixies, and Atlantic rainforests were cited in those books an awful lot because they have that mystical, you know, magical, you know, it's a bit like, you know, Lord of the Rings with Fangorn Forest. It's that kind of thing. It has a magical air about
them. You
definitely
see, like, druids.
Yeah, absolutely.
Little,
so
toadstool circles and all
sorts. So I think it's no more than that, really, is that the rainforests, because of their wet, damp and moss-covered environment, creates that real mystical habitat.
I mean, I very much want to go on a tour of the UK's rainforests now. And
we definitely
need to do
should.
The birdie bug pod on the road.
And, we definitely should. And there's actually some really good examples spread all over. Dartmoor's a great place to go. There's a place called the White Wood in Dartmoor.
That sounds like something from Lord of the Rings,
which
as well,
is a stunning expanse of Atlantic oak wood. And in spring, you know, it is full of pied flycatchers, apparently, so I need to go there. Obviously, I mentioned there's some really amazing temperate rainforest up in Scotland. Glasdrum in Argyll is one. Arundel Oakwood in the Highlands of Scotland.
They've all got such great names.
Another one in Devon called Lusley Cleeve. One in Wales called Tye Cannel in Pembrokeshire, which is an emerald jewel of moss-covered boulders and gnarled dripping trees.
Oh,
people
great.
Have coexisted with this wood for thousands of years, and there's a Neolithic burial chamber in it as well. So there are temperate rainforests still to be found, and we've definitely got to go and find some. We were down in Dartmoor a few years ago, and we should have gone and found one then, shouldn't we? So that's got to be done.
Yeah.
But yes, so they can be found west coast of Scotland, north and west Wales, Devon, Cornwall, Cumbria, and parts of Northern Ireland. There's temperate rainforest in Northern Ireland as well. So there's plenty to
explore.
So
in that case, probably time to move on to the reason they've declined. You've obviously mentioned that they once covered a fifth and they now cover less than 1%.
Yeah.
I've actually got, there's about 30,000 hectares remaining in the UK, which is just a real fraction of what it used to be. And I think there's about 18, I found a few statistics. I don't know how up to date they were, about 15 to 18,000 hectares left in England.
Yeah, I think I mentioned that earlier.
Yeah.
And about 30,000 in Scotland,
yeah.
I think.
So there's a variety of reasons, and a lot of them are similar to our normal habitat decline. Obviously, with any sort of woodland or forest, deforestation is a huge one. They were cleared for fuel, obviously. Wood was used very heavily for
actually,
fuel.
But going back to the Stone Age, they started to clear, didn't they? Once they started to get tools, they started to clear wood for fire and you know, for making fire, all sorts of things, for making axes, for
building materials in general. But then obviously, like I said, similar to all of our habitat episodes, farming practices have played a huge part in it, clearing the woodland so that you could either grow animals or crops.
It's overgrazing definitely is a huge factor.
But one of the ones I wanted to go into slightly more, because it's different to our normal contenders or culprits, is air pollution. And so it ties in slightly to what I spoke about with the lichens. But essentially, the airborne pollutants that you get from many things like cars and roads and industry, things like sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides, really damage sensitive epiphytic plants, so the ones that we've already spoken about, things like the mosses, the ferns, and then also the lichens, which in a lot of these articles they bunch lichens in with these plants, and obviously as we've learned they're not plants, but they are impacted by the same sort of air pollution. But the real big issue is nitrogen gases, which essentially have the potential to destroy a lot of these rainforests. And the pollution in the air sort of forms a type of ammonia emission, which comes from things like farm manures, fertilizers, and you also get nitrogen oxide from things like fossil fuels, but also the agricultural industry. And there's a thing called the critical load, and it's essentially the amount of pollutants that something, either a person, like an animal, or a habitat, can be exposed to before significant harmful impacts start to be sort of visible. And data shows that about 66% of our temperate rainforest zones have exceeded their critical load. So many areas of sort of England and Wales, the overabundance of these nitrogen sort of pollutants go way beyond this threshold. And in the long term, that does things like stagnates a lot of the growth. It causes things like discoloration, increases the vulnerability of these habitats to things like drought, frost, and disease. And so it really does hit them quite hard. And given that they are well known for their sort of air purifying abilities, but also the real preference for the species that live there for clean air. And it makes sense, you know, you've got the lichens and ferns and mosses on the forest floor that want the clean oxygen. You've got the trees purifying it all, perfect for all the organisms underneath. Yeah. As soon as you start destroying the trees and the air quality goes down, everything that else lives in there starts to struggle. And so they're really having a difficult time because of air pollution, which I thought was quite interesting and also sad.
Yeah, that is very sad. I've got a couple of things to mention as well that they're affected by. We've talked about this actually in an episode we did about non-native species, rhododendrons. Rhododendrons have been called the most damaging and most widespread non-native terrestrial plant in Britain. Yeah. And it was introduced in the UK around 1760. It's a really aggressive coloniser, and it completely reduces the biodiversity of a value of a site. We talked about that before. It spreads really quickly. Nothing grows underneath it.
Yeah, it just out-competes everything.
It out-competes everything. It's really, really difficult once it gets established and very costly to eradicate, and that's had a big impact on temperate rainforest. And then this other thing, which again, and I wanted to mention it because we probably mention it in every episode, is the fragmentation of that habitat. Because they've become more and more fragmented, they've lost connection, you know, they're not connected in larger areas as they used to be. So that fragmentation of the rainforest reduces its resilience against all those other threats, like you've just talked about there, pest diseases, air pollution, climate change. As soon as you get a fragmented habitat, it's much harder for it to be resilient against those threats.
If you've got a really small rainforest and 95% of it dies because of disease, it's not going to fight back.
No.
If you've got a massive rainforest, then there's much higher chance that some of those trees will survive or will have a tolerance to it. And it's the same with obviously, like animals in general. Like,
we've talked about that a lot.
If you try and reintroduce a population for a very small genetic pool and they're vulnerable to a disease, it just wipes them all out.
Yeah.
It's actually a really big issue with cheetahs in Africa.
Is it?
Yeah, it happened with a lot of interbreeding with the cheetah populations. And so they are very genetically not diverse at all. So there's a real concern that things like a disease could really decimate them because they're just not diverse at all.
So
you want lots of genetic interchange between the rainforests and the habitats and stuff, and not this little pool of one one small genetic pool.
Yeah.
But fragmentation we've spoken about, I think, in almost every episode.
I think we have.
such an issue.
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely. So they've got lots of threats that they're battling against. Have you got anything else to add to that?
The only thing is, I mean, all the normal stuff, but also a specific threat is the ash dieback, which is another non-native, but it's a fungus that kills European ash trees. We've got a little robin flying at the window. But it doesn't only attack the ancient trees, it also has an impact on the lichens. So essentially, it's just another disease, which obviously, as we've mentioned, things like fragmentation and all these stuff that make the forest vulnerable is only going to increase the issues surrounding that fungal disease.
Yeah.
But otherwise, we can move on to the more positive side of news.
Yeah, there's a little sentence here that I thought really resonated with me. When it comes to temperate rainforests, Britain truly is world-beating. We've got a good level, even though we've only got 1% left in the world. Yet we call on Brazil and Indonesia to save their rainforests. We're always, aren't we? We're the first to say Brazil are cutting down their rainforests, Indonesia, all of those nations that host these incredible environments are just allowing it to happen. And yet we don't own up to the fact that Britain is a rainforest nation too, and one that we cut most of our own rainforest
down. It's a really good point, actually.
It's a very good point, isn't it? Because
easy to point fingers.
Absolutely, but we don't do that. But I think things are changing, and there is some good news, and there are a number of projects that are going on that encouraged me hugely, particularly when the first one that I read about was government-led. Now, I hasten to add that this government-led project that has started was started under the Conservative government and Rishi Sunak. So whether the current government is continuing with this project, I'm not sure. I need to do more research on that. But it started a temperate rainforest strategy for England, which has been a huge thing, actually. And it's a government-backed rainforest strategy which will raise the profile of this habitat, show farmers, landowners and the public what an important ecosystem and in need of protection and restoration it needs. And honestly, there's so much information on this that I could talk about it forever. But a huge amount of money has been pushed into research and develop temperate rainforests. They're working with local authorities and encouraging them to include temperate rainforest restoration in their local nature recovery strategies, national park authorities in their management plans. There are 7 new landscape recovery pilots involving temperate rainforest restoration. And there's a plan to recover to restore England's largest temperate rainforest, and they've turned it into a national nature reserve. And that is the one in Borrowdale, up in Cumbria. It's a 721-hectare National Trust site. It's the wettest inhabited place in England. The rainfall in the upper end of the valley is twice that of the lower end, which is was created this landscape that drips with lush vegetation. And there's this massive project to restore it, which I think is fantastic. There are lots and lots more directives in this government-led strategy, and I'm not going to list them all. It suffice to say, it's been recognised how important they are, and for the government to actually recognise it and start actually, you know, really getting onto it and
across a large scale,
pushing money in, and working with everything from local authorities to landowners and farmers, and that's happening across the whole country. So Cornwall, Devon, Somerset, Cumbria, and I was really encouraged. I sat reading a huge amount about that, and it was fantastic to read. 34 new pilot sites, loads and loads of stuff on it.
I mean, we'll stick a
link a link to it in there, because if you want to go on and read a bit more about that strategy, then please do. But like I say, that was implemented under the Tory government, and that in itself was quite a thing that made me fall off my chair, because I didn't think the Tory government was interested at all in any kind of biodiversity, climate change, habitat restoration, wildlife at all.
Yeah, we'll have to.
It was a pretty neglectful, if that's the right word, government in that respect. So to read that that happened and was actually implemented under the Tory government was fantastic.
We will obviously we'll keep an eye out for updates to see if we can find out whether the, what the Labour government are doing as far as continuing this work, changing the plan, improving the plan, not improving the plan, and then if any updates. If I do see any updates, we'll bring it as a little note through in one of the podcast episodes. So we'll keep an eye on the this project to see how it develops.
So can I carry on this?
Yeah,
there's,
keep going.
There's another one again, which was fantastic to read because again, it highlights an example of where we're very quick to criticise big corporations for their. Their neglect or their
greenwashing
reticence, about you know anything climate, environment, or whatever. And this one actually highlights a very big corporation that's doing some amazing work. There's something called the Wildlife Trusts Project, which is run across all the wildlife trusts across the country in conjunction with the Lost Rainforests of Britain. We'll put a link into that because that's
a really
actually
cool project.
A really cool project. And it's a 100-year program to establish new rainforests and reconnect existing sites. The aim is to restore approximately 1,755 hectares of temperate rainforest across the British Isles. And it'll go a step further than traditional habitat restoration and will work to create entirely new rainforests on eligible sites across this bioclimatic envelope, the area typically
suitable
for Atlantic rainforest. And it's been made possible by a really generous donation from Aviva. Aviva is the company that's given them the opportunity to do this. And what I didn't realise, in fact, I'll just carry on with what the aim of it all is. The course of the programme, 1,755 hectares of rainforest will be created, which will create an estimated 222,000 tons of carbon sequestered by 2050, which is doubling and doubling to 440,000 tons by 2060. Amazing new sites will be created, include Bowden Pillars in Devon, Bryn Iffen in North Wales, Craig E. Cohen and Cleon Dara, excuse my pronunciations, on the Isle of Man. Trellin Fark.
That's rude.
Fark.
And that's more rude.
Fark. How do you pronounce F-A-C-H? Fack? Fatch? Farch?
I have no idea.
In Pembrokeshire. And most recently, Skiddaw. Sounded all right.
Yeah, I think it was fine.
Trellin Fark. Okay. And Skiddaw in Cumbria. I'll leave a link to that so you can actually look it up properly. Each site will be owned and managed by local wildlife trusts, and it's a 100-year project. But I then went on to read about what an amazing example of Aviva is setting.
I forgot who Aviva are.
They're a
are
big they? Insurance company, aren't they, Aviva? I think they do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think they're a big insurance company. So They've been working really, really hard. And apparently there's this thing where you can invest to draw down carbon for the future. Do you know anything about that?
Was it carbon storage?
Yeah, carbon storing and stuff like that. And, of course, there's an awful lot of greenwashing that goes on in that respect. So
things like carbon credits are always...
Carbon credits.
Concern is the wrong word. I think they promise a lot more than they deliver.
But Aviva has shown it's taking real action to reduce its emissions. And between 2010 and 2021... Aviva cut its own operational greenhouse gas emissions by 66% and ensured the detail was publicly disclosed and demonstrable.
That's a hard word to say, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was for me. Demonstrable. and it's committed to become net zero by 2030. But the difference is with Aviva is that they can actually demonstrate that, and I think that's the difference. A lot of these big corporations are claiming that they're you know, that they're reducing their emissions, but they can't actually demonstrate it, and they can't actually prove it. And Aviva was doing this as proved it, and are working incredibly hard. They're an incredible example. Again, I will put some links in at the end. You can, in the show notes, that you can read more about the work that Aviva are doing. Normally, you know, these big corporations, we're very quick to criticise, we're very quick to talk greenwashing, we're very quick to say, yeah, they claim they're doing that, but really they're not. We're very quick to criticise them when they dump chemicals into rivers and drop sewage into seas and all of that stuff. But it's really, really, it was really, really encouraging to read about a big corporation like Aviva that are actually really pushing hard and working alongside wildlife trusts. And that's the other thing, that affiliation with organisations like the Wildlife Trusts are really important. And to see them working, and the fact that this 100-year project couldn't have gone ahead without, I think they initially put 40 million investment into the start of that project.
Charities struggle to do that sort of thing
without a big corporation. So I was very, very encouraged by that.
You know, it's rightly so that we criticise organisations when they do bad, and also when they try and make themselves look good when they're not. But it is important to recognise the ones that are doing good, because the big organisations, these big corporations, aren't going anywhere. They're not going to disappear. And you know, there's always an argument that when they do the good green stuff, they are simply doing it to tick a box, but that doesn't matter. If putting the requirement for companies to tick a box makes them do good things, then whether or not it's done to make themselves look good or out the goodness of their own heart makes no difference. The action is still really important. And I say they're not going anywhere. We're not going to take down the big corporations that rule much of the world, the Amazons and McDonald's and all these the big companies. And so when they do put aside a big chunk of their money, and they have a lot of it, to do something good, they should be recognised then it hopefully encourages other organisations to do the same.
Definitely. And I think they're not just box ticking, and they're not just for once I think they're not just box ticking, they're not just hitting a target because they've got to or attempting to hit a target. I think they're genuinely on a mission and recognize the importance of the actions that they're taking, and they are a huge example, and that's the hope, is that other big corporations, you know, take that example and think, you know, that's an amazing thing that they're doing.
So yeah, I think, you know, we have to be able to criticise and praise, you know, people and organisations for doing.
Yeah, I mean, there are others, as ever. The RSPB is involved and working with the Celtic Rainforests in Wales. There's projects, and they're backed by the Welsh Government as well. So the Welsh Government are doing some good stuff in Scotland. 24 organisations are working for the rainforests as part of the Alliance of Scotland's Rainforests, and the RSPB is one of the leading alliances that they're working with. Saving Morven's Rainforest, which is really important. So there's lots and lots of things. Another good charity that we talked about, Plant Life, fantastic website. Go on there, we'll stick a link. They're working with governments and landowners, educating to protect and restore temperate rainforests.
Plant Life, there's on the slightly more local scale, Plant Life, Rewilding Britain and Woodland Trust are all working to restore rainforests by doing things like removing the invasive species, trying to reduce the grazing pressures and replanting native species. So on that sort of local restoration level across much of the UK, those organisations are working to replenish and restore.
There's another little nugget here that we'll like. Citizen science volunteers working with Plant Life.
Always out there doing the tree planting.
Have rediscovered 15 fragments of lost rainforests. This is all citizen science. 15 important new sites of rainforests identified. A team of trained volunteers have surveyed nearly 300 woodlands across the regions used by Plant Life's rapid rainforest assessment, understanding the environment, and they have discovered 15 high quality rainforest locations, and found new records of rainforest indicator species such as the oceanic liverworts, and all sorts of lichens and rare species as well. So it's been a fantastic citizen science project. But to discover 15 fragments of lost rainforest was fantastic. So we love a bit of citizen science. We applaud them. We admire them.
I am one. Yeah.
And it just again highlights the importance of
everyone getting out there and
volunteering and giving up a little bit of time to help projects and organisations like Plant Life. So there's a whole raft of probably more encouraging good news stories about trying to save, protect and restore temperate rainforests than any other episode we've done. So I was genuinely encouraged and found it really nice heartwarming.
I often do the research for these episodes in the structure that we go through them. So I'll start with a bit of introduction, start with species, and then I'll type in and research the threats. And then I'll do the positive stuff. And sometimes it's a struggle. And you've been reading all doom and gloom. And then there's just like, oh, it's actually...
We've had a few, haven't we?
Yeah,
where it's been a real struggle.
It's been quite hard to try and find it. But to be able to get to the end of the research, be like, oh, do you know what? Actually, there's things happening. It was a nice, uplifting way to finish the research.
Yeah, and to actually find a really serious and large government-backed project, that was the thing that really made me think.
Definitely one for us to keep an eye on as well.
Yeah, definitely. I need to do a little bit more research on that to see whether the new Labour government has continued with that project. And so we will do that, and we will catch you up on that in consequent episodes. So I think that's about it for me on
temperate rainforest. I hope people have enjoyed learning a bit about our rainforests and maybe find time to go and visit one. Thing is we've got to do a post and we haven't got a photo of a rainforest, so maybe we just need to go right now.
Yeah, we need to go there. Well, Dartmoor's not that far away. And I love Dartmoor. It's one of my favourite places on the planet there, actually, Dartmoor. So
but yeah, hopefully you've enjoyed it. As always, the little sort of social media side stuff, we do have an Instagram account at the Birdie Bug Pod, so please do go and give it a follow. We're gradually starting to populate it with content in between the episode
announcements. Taking the piss out of me, you mean?
Yeah, I did put a clip of Dad's wild guess at a curlew's weight, so if you want a little flashback to that, go and check out.
I'm hugely embarrassed by that because I'm the bird man, and I should know these things. And curlews are one of my favourite bird species.
It's not easy.
World.
I should have made it multiple choice. And I will, once I remember how to do the editing, post a clip of myself doing a wild guess at, I think it was how much an elephant
drinks.
It was like
10 litres or something. Yeah, so. It turned out to be about 100 times that.
Yeah, so, but for...
Yeah, you'll note that he didn't do his. He just took the mickey out of me.
Yeah,
so.
That's my, my right.
Yeah, well, I guess so. That's what dads are for, isn't it?
Yeah, so please do
mickey taken out of them.
Go find at the Birdie Bug Pod on Instagram, because we are going to start putting out some hopefully more entertaining but also just general content. It is also a good spot if you want to ping us a message to either give feedback, correct us on anything we've got wrong, tell us if you've been to one of our rainforests or anything like that, then do head over to Instagram.
Yeah, and absolutely.
Don't forget to like, review, subscribe, whatever the podcast platform you listen to this on actually allows you to do, because they all seem to be different, but it really helps people find the podcast. So
you're going to end up doing one of those really terms fast, and conditions really fast at the end.
Speed it up at the end.
anyway, thanks very much for listening, and we will catch you next time.
Thank you. Bye.